session, Chief Judge Craig H. Nakamura, Associate Judge Daniel R. Foley, and Circuit Court Judge Stephen F. Ong presiding. Please be seated. Case number 28958, C. Brewer & Company Limited v. Industrial Indemnity Co. et al. Kenneth R. Kupchak and Ted Ierley for Plaintiff Appellant C. Brewer & Company Limited, Reese R. Nakamura for Defendant Cross Appellant State of Hawaii, and William Meheula for Defendant Cross Appellant Kehaulani Holdings Company, Inc. Susan Field and Lisa Andrews for Appellee United States Fire Insurance Company, Michelle Lynn Lute for Appellee's Tradewind Insurance Company and Island Insurance, William A. Bordner for Appellee's Lexington Insurance Company and National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Bradford Bliss for Appellee Columbia Casualty Insurance Company, Paul White for Appellee Marine Indemnity Insurance Company of America, Peter Olson for Appellee First State Insurance Company, Shelton Jim On for Appellee's Ace Property and Casualty Insurance Company and Pacific Employers Insurance Company, Robert Romero and Keith Hiraoka for Appellee's Fireman's Fund Insurance Company of Hawaii, Inc. and James River Insurance Company, James Monma for Appellee Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, and Wesley Shimazu for Appellee Scottsdale Insurance Company. Argument on the merits.
Good afternoon, everyone. We have a cast of thousands today. Counselor, ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. May it please the court. My name is Kenneth Kupchak, representing C. Brewer. I have an agreement with Mr. Meheula, Mr. Nakamura, that I will do the opening after 20 minutes and reserving 25 for rebuttal. We too are interested because neither the court nor the appellants sought oral argument what the challenge to Sentinel is supposed to be. We're particularly interested because in U.S. Fire's opening answering brief, they start off in the first sentence by saying this appeal only deals with one issue for the CGO characters. Under Pfluger's allegations, three Supreme Court cases, including Sentinel's adoption of the injury in fact trigger, confirmed that a duty to defend is required in this case. The trial court erred in deciding otherwise. In Hawaii, we know that termites gnaw our beams. Our homes have been damaged, even though the home doesn't fall down. It is possible, based on Pfluger's allegations, this is exactly what has happened here. Therefore, the insurers must defend. The insurers are trying to apply a bright line trigger. They want to shift this court's focus to the manifestation of a collapsing dam. They ignore Pfluger's allegations of injury in fact occurring during each policy period. Sentinel specifically rejected bright line manifestation trigger. As long as the property damage is ascertained in retrospect, there's coverage and defense is required. Let's examine some of the allegations. Even though the underlying Sentinel complaint did not allege that when the damage occurred, Pfluger here has specifically alleged that the equivalent of termite damage occurred in every period. Pfluger alleged that a failure to repair and maintain resulted in the dam continuously falling into disrepair. Disrepair is damage per se. Even Black's Dictionary says that disrepair is a state of being in need of repair or restoration after decay or injury. Pfluger also alleged that rusting floodgates became inoperable. Rusted floodgates are damaged floodgates. Pfluger alleged that for decades, trees had been allowed to grow on the dam slope. Trees growing on the dam slope caused damage to the dam. Sentinel isn't about the quantum of damage, only its existence. If there's any question of whether Pfluger was claiming damage in every policy period, he answered this unequivocally yes. His interrogatory answer that the failure to maintain resulted in continuous, incremental, and indivisible process damage to the dam in every one of the policy periods. Allegations regarding how a failure to repair or maintain might cause a dam to collapse make no sense unless the failure results in prior, continuous, incremental damage to the dam. C. Brewer is entitled to such an interpretation on a motion to dismiss and under Dairy Road and Tri-S.
Are the same allegations of continuous damage made in the Fairing and the Midler complaints?
They are, Your Honor, but we maintain that the Pfluger complaint covers all periods, and that's the main one we're focusing on. The issue on the Fairing and Midler cases is that they didn't suffer any damage prior to collapse. It's Pfluger, the state of Hawaii, and Lucas that have the possibility of damage in their period if there was incremental damage along the dam or the gates.
So why is there a duty to defend in the Fairing and the Midler cases?
Because Pfluger's in those cases and he's making the same things, same complaints back at us. And the damages, let's assume there was a modicum of damage pre-collapse. Everything thereafter may be a consequence of that. So the damages of the Fairings and the Midlers are part of that consequential.
But is there any duty to defend against the claims made by the plaintiffs in Fairing and Midler?
Only to the extent, in my mind, that Pfluger is seeking indemnity and contribution against those claims, right? And therefore that gets drawn in as the consequences in the Pfluger case. So those particular damages, we say, are part of the Pfluger aspect of this. James River covers both policies periods, and it's in for the Fairing and Midler ones.
Right, I'm talking about the pre-breach CGL policies at this point.
I understand, and as far as I'm concerned, it's primarily Pfluger, the state, and the Lucas estate. The line for the dam, where that was, how much is Pfluger and how much is Lucas's, needed to be determined in the underlying merits cases. Okay. Now, without any logic or support, carriers claim that even if Pfluger is alleging that the dam has been continuously damaged, he is not seeking this damage. Pfluger never said he wasn't seeking recovery for continuous, incremental, indivisible dam damage. This is, after all, his dam. Pfluger states every count in his prayer for relief that he is seeking to be awarded such damages that he may prove at trial. Nowhere does Pfluger waive such an entitlement. Waivers are to be not implied and strictly construed when they exist. More to the point, Pfluger desperately needed to prove this damage to divert attention from himself and the other cases. Therefore, we had every right to expect that he would spiritedly present these issues in the merits cases. The carriers seem to believe that they can force every insured to hang itself in the coverage action at the risk of possibly obtaining a defense in the merits cases. This is the Procrustean dilemma that Dairy Road prescribed. An insured is not forced to educate the merits plaintiffs suing it below with a roadmap to the insured's possible culpability. Allegations of damage within all policy periods were apparent from the allegations in Pfluger's complaint. Yet, without a trial on the issue in the merits action, let alone in the subsidiary coverage action, the trial court ignored Pfluger's allegations, which had to be treated as true. It essentially found that Pfluger was lying on a motion to dismiss and dismissed the carriers for CGL policies. This defrauded not only Pfluger, who isn't even a party in this action, but also the appellants of their due process right to contest the court's findings that as a matter of law, no damage to the dam occurred prior to the collapse. In essence, the trial judge prejudged the merits cases. If the CGL carriers believed that there was no possible allegation of damage within a policy period, they should have defended. They should have brought an action or a motion against Pfluger on behalf of C. Brewer on these points. The carriers didn't do that because they know that would have been frivolous. See, Brewer is entitled to the reversal of the trial court's factual determination that there could be no damage prior to March 20, 2006. Simply put, the court made a factual finding on a motion to dismiss. Columbia Casualty represents the second appeal issue. It claims that Brewer must prove its knowledge of damage in the coverage action before the same disputed issue is covered in the merits actions. This raises at a minimum the specter of multiple litigations and inconsistent results. Whether Brewer knew of damage to the dam, and if so, when, is a material issue alleged and denied in the merits cases. Again, Gary Road and Trias, under Gary Road and Trias, the coverage action should have been stayed pending a determination on the merits on C. Brewer's knowledge. Had the courts done this, one possible outcome might have been that as a merit fact determination during Columbia's policy period, C. Brewer sold its interest in the company which is allegedly responsible for maintaining and repairing the dam. C. Brewer, which denied knowledge of the damage to the dam below, would not know if, after the sale, the maintenance company changed its practice, which are alleged to have caused the previous period's damage. If it did, further continuous incremental damage might have possibly ceased. If so, Columbia's knowledge requirement might have been satisfied. This savings provision in the Columbia policy, quoted on page 7 of its brief, says that if the insured didn't know of the damage before or during the policy period, and the damage changed, didn't continue, or resume thereafter, then the damage is presumed to occur within Columbia's policy period. With the possibility of the merits action might moot this knowledge condition, Columbia owed a defense under Gary Road. Damage within the James River policy period is not an issue. The trial court dismissed James River on a mistaken belief that the claim damage had to occur at a listed property. The policy doesn't so state.
Well, what's the purpose of the listed policy exception if any decision made from the policy, regardless of whether the injury occurs, is covered? Well, why would an insurance company put that in the policy under your interpretation of what it means?
There, you have to read the policy as a whole. There's a provision in the policy. It says coverage is granted for advertising torts, which is non-premises specific. Other courts have held that that creates an ambiguity on the premises aspect. On top of that, the cases which have been cited deal with a question of whether or not there is a necessity, or I mean, the operation from which the tort arose is necessary incidental to the premises, to tie it back to something that's going on the premises. That provision, which is in the other cases, would split on the issue of whether it allows business unrelated premises be covered, doesn't occur in our policy. So we don't have that tie-in. In addition, in our policy, we have a business operational coverage. That operational business is described as a real estate owner's business, as alleged by Pfluger and others. From 1977 on, Brewer has been in the real estate owner's business. In the policy itself, it shows we have 100 pieces of property still. And Pfluger alleges that we're in the process of dissolving and selling off this property. If we have a requirement to, tie it back into the business operation, which is the real estate business on it, it's a definition that's not defined, and if it's vague and ambiguous, it should be construed against the policyholder. But under that business, if you wanted to sell the properties today, these 100 properties, how you treated the properties that you previously had might be relevant to those potential buyers. So it ties in under the business operation premises. To the extent there's an ambiguity between the two, in this case, then we went on that basis as well.
So are there any limits to that portion of it describing as a real estate operation? Are there any limits to that?
Excuse me?
Are there any limit when, if you're saying it's not one of these specific properties, but it's being tied into their general duties as a real estate.
I'm saying that the cases at site try to, some of them deny coverage, but those cases have a specific thing saying that it has to be incidental and necessary to the premises. This policy doesn't require that.
Maybe the question is the reverse. Why would an insurance company put those provisions in if they're going to be read as expansively as you claim they should be read?
The answer on the other side of that is why they put in the business operation one, and why didn't they tie it to the incidental? But nonetheless, you put in the properties and listed so you know which ones are there, and it has to. I believe no matter how you read it, the alleged torts have to emanate. The action has to emanate there. The damage doesn't have to be at the place where it emanated. I don't believe any of the cases say that you can only recover if both the damage and the tortious act occurred at the listed premises. There are cases where that's been true, but it wasn't because the policy said that was the only thing it covered.
But the nexus you're saying is sufficient is that a decision that turns out to be negligent was made at the headquarters, as long as the headquarters is listed. So I guess my question is, why would an insurance company put that in? Because that seems a very expansive provision. If any decision that could arguably be claimed to be negligent would invoke coverage, why would an insurance company put that in as an exclusion?
This is a CGL policy. This is not a first-party property policy. And you're supposed to cover the torts that occur on it. And slander, libel, advertising torts. What are those? Those are business management things. The case that we cited, American Guarantee, says negligent management is a covered item. The business operation is covered. This is the business operation out of which the alleged duties are supposed to emanate. The office is specifically a listed property. So as to the action that's been alleged to create the problem, seems to have occurred at the office, a listed property. And it's only a question of where the damage is. And I'm suggesting that no case is held that it has to be at the listed property. So hopefully I've answered that question. And I'm here to tell you that I believe the policy is ambiguous. The policy is issued to Brewer LTD. There is no such company. It says real estate business, real estate owner business, real estate owner. Doesn't define what that is. Has the advertising tort in it, has a property, a business operation, and it says a list of premises. How do you read all that together? I'm suggesting that the alleged negligent actions at the office that is listed, wherever the damage occurred, they're on the hook for it. And that's why we want a defense. Hopefully they'll be able to establish there wasn't anything connected out of it. They would have saved themselves a lot of problems if they come in and brought that motion against Fluger. So I think I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Can I ask a question on the first-party property insurance?
Sure, certainly.
Is there any claim that there's a duty to defend on those policies?
No.
All right, so it's purely an indemnity question as to that.
It's property. We're going to damage property. And the policies deal with control.
What were the property interests of Brewer that was, of C. Brewer, that was damaged during the pre-breach period for purposes of the property insurance policy?
In the pre-breach period?
Well, the first party insurance policies are all prior to the dam breach, correct?
No. I believe some are still after the fact. But I whatever the chart says it is, I can commit that to memory. There are 45 policies. Fine. What's alleged is that, one, the stock should come back to us. We had the stock in KIC. It went from 95 to 2005. Prior to that time, other than the stock, we say that Brewer never owned any property and never operated anything on it. The policies say that it covers for things you controlled or used, and it's alleged by Brewer that we're essentially the alter ego of these operations that are occurring. Now, if you were the irrigation company or if you were Brewer Properties on it, you had an insurable interest in the dam under the water rights agreement. They had an easement. Easements are covered under James River, I believe, and this property for different reasons, but the easements are covered here. So that, and Kilauea Irrigation Company sold the water. So if the dam is being damaged in some way that the water is less than it should have had, they're making less money. So the maintenance of that dam, from damage to the dam, whether it be caused by Pfluger for filling in the spillway or something else up the system, Kilauea Irrigation and Seaboard Properties have an insurable interest to fix that dam. So you have to work all the way back through the policies to get that, to deal with the allegations. These are the allegations that are made. We're hoping that under the defense with the CGLs, we never get there. But assume that it's found that we were essentially the only ego there, then it's our dam, and we have a shareable interest in it to make sure it worked.
What would the measure of damage be in that situation? How is Brewer's insurable interest, how would you value the injury to that insurable interest?
There's several questions tied up in that. One is as I mentioned, the quantum. Quantum's not required for defense, and these are essentially defense cases in the first instance for the non-property cases.
I'm asking about the property case. You've already said there's no duty to defend on the property insurance. My question is, what would be the indemnifiable loss for the property insurance, first-party property insurance cases?
Let's assume that it's termite damage equivalent. If you get through all the mechanics of how a dam works, it doesn't operate with its roots and what have you on it, our damage would have been to repair that. Now, Pfluger's alleged is a $1.8 million worth of repair necessary.
And you're saying your property insurance would cover it even though the dam is owned by Pfluger?
Meaning the alter ego, had insurable interest in that dam because I had an easement over it to maintain it, and I needed that for my water business, and I had a 50% interest in the water coming out of there. Lucas had the other 50% interest. Pfluger had no interest in the water. So the Kilauea Irrigation, made its money by selling the water. And the rates of that business theoretically should have supported all the operations and maintenance back this way. So if I have a weir that's down, that's a property problem, and I can get my coverage to cover that.
You know, in the first part, for the defend, you talked about the pleadings and you talked about the interrogatory. You didn't mention the Godby report. Is there a reason for that? Are you valuing it different as its role?
Well, the Godby report's in our complaint. What it does is that shows you the mechanism of one potential allegation is what's wrong with the dam that may have caused it to have problems. The Godby report explains it. So if anybody had any questions of whether this is a harebrained theory about termites, Godby shows it out there. There's somebody thinking that, and there's a possibility they might be right. At the end of the day, if we've been defended, we've been saying the dam was in perfect shape. And it stood for 100 years. It was Pfluger filled in the spillway, topped the dam, killed it in an hour. That's what we'd like to have had these guys come out and say. Pfluger says, not so fast. You guys didn't do something that either made the dam fail sooner or I have insurable interest to repair anyway. And that all contributed to the end of consequential damages. I'll reserve the rest of our time.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court. We're here today, as the court knows, because of the March 14th, 2006 dam breach, which caused the death of 7 people and millions of dollars of property damage. I'm here to speak for U.S. Fire, who issued policies from 1987 to 1995, all before the dam breach, in fact, more than a decade before the dam breach, as well as other insurers whose policies have similar terms to those of my client, and whose policies also expired before the dam breach. Now, Brewer and the state, actually, appellants, have sued all of the insurers, arguing that they all owed a duty to defend the complaints that were brought as a result of that terrible flood. And so I know that there has been enormous amount of briefing, and there have been many arguments made. But the real question here is the simple one, and is that is, do the insurers whose policies expired before the dam breach owe a duty to defend? We believe the answer to that is no. The trial court held the answer was no, and we believe that when this court looks at this matter again, de novo, this court will conclude as well that the answer is no. Counsel actually asked the question as to how we were going to challenge Sentinel. We don't intend to challenge Sentinel. Sentinel is good law, and we think actually that it supports our position. So the question here is, how do we look at the duty to defend? Everybody agrees the duty to defend is tested by the actual policy language of the policies and the actual complaints and the pleadings that we're looking at and what they allege. And that's very important when we get to the issue of looking at those claims. I noted that counsel had several times referred to Derry Road. And there is a line in Derry Road that talks about the fact that the courts need to be very careful to examine the complaint to ensure that plaintiffs could not, through artful pleading, bootstrap the availability of insurance coverage under an insured defendant's policy by purporting to state a claim for negligence based on facts that simply aren't there. So I'd ask this court, when it goes back, to look at this matter de novo, to look at the policy language and to look at the complaints that are at issue. The policy language is simple, and there have been some restatements of the policy language. The policy language at issue here says this insurance applies only to bodily injury and property damage, which occurs during the policy period. So the question that this court needs to answer is, do the complaints at issue allege bodily injury or property damage which occurred during the policy period?
If the complaints were consistent with Pfluger's interrogatory answer. In other words, if there is an allegation in the complaint that for the past 20 years there have been continuous, ongoing, indivisible damage to the dam, would that require a duty to defend?
Well, I guess I have two responses to that. One is I don't think that's what the answer to interrogatory says. But second of all, it would not require a duty to defend the Midler or Farring complaints under any circumstances.
All right, what about the Pfluger complaint?
The Pfluger complaint is a closer call, and I will concede that. But I don't believe that that's what was alleged in the pleading itself, and that's important.
But does the actual language of the Pfluger complaint preclude him recovering those damage to the dam based upon an ongoing theory under the allegations as in the complaint itself?
I just don't think that the complaint itself makes that allegation, and I don't believe that the answer to interrogatory, an interrogatory that Brewer created, after all, this leading interrogatory to send to them to see if they could, in this way, create, as Derry Road says,
Away the interrogatory, then. If it's possible that Pfluger could recover damage for ongoing, historical, incremental damage to the dam, wouldn't that require a duty to defend until, in that litigation, you prove that those damages did not exist?
It would raise the issue of, does it meet this initial burden? That is, does it fall within something that's alleged that is property damage which allegedly occurred during the policy period? But the answer to that is, does it require a duty to defend? The answer to that is no. So if I could just, first of all, go back to Farring and Midler, because I think those are important. And counsel indicated, I think, that Brewer contends, and the state contended in its reply brief, that somehow the incorporation of some claim by Pfluger into his cross-complaint in those cases somehow created a duty to defend those complaints. I don't believe that's the law. The law is you look at the complaint at issue. And if you look at the Pfluger cross-complaint anyway, what the Pfluger cross-complaint was an indemnity claim saying, I'm not liable, you're liable for their damages. And their damages simply could not have occurred at any date before March 14, 2006.
So your argument is that as to the Farring and the Midler complaints, it's all a line, and the cross claims don't go beyond the scope of the complaint.
And they can't change what happened to those people. I mean, the Hawaii case law holds I think it's Moore versus Allstate, that even if there's an allegation in a complaint that makes no sense, you don't have to accept it. And so even if somebody said, for example, that the Faring plaintiffs suffered injury before March 14, 2006, this court wouldn't have to accept that, because we all know, as a matter of fact, that the flood happened on that day, before that date, and I hate to say it this way, those people were alive, and the next day they were not. The damage to the property by the Midler plaintiffs, the day before, their property wasn't damaged, the day after the flood, it was. So that, in that case, for those cases, is a bright line rule that this court should not stray from. But as to Pfluger, if in fact there were allegations in that complaint of ongoing damage, I think that Sentinel would say, and I think other cases would say, that there is the possibility of property damage. I would then say to this court that, one, I don't believe that's what either the complaint says. When we go back and we look at the allegations of the complaint, they talk about system-wide. They don't talk about damage to the dam. They talk about a trees growing in a dam. Well, this is an earthen dam. I think we'd have to speculate to suggest that that constitutes damage. We look at the Godby report. Judge Ong, you mentioned the Godby report. The Godby report doesn't say there is damage. It doesn't even say that there was damage earlier. It talks about a mechanism of failure. It talks about negligence that might have occurred before that.
Right. He uses the term possibility, though, right?
It uses the words possibility of a cause. Mm-hmm. It doesn't use the words possibility of damage. And again, this goes back to the question as to what we're looking at. And we have cases which we cited in our papers, which are actually quite similar to the situation, cases involving landslides and floods. And in those cases, the courts did make a distinction we think this court should make, between allegations of negligence and allegation of property damage and bodily injury. The cases that perhaps are most similar to ours is the Great Lakes case. That's the case involving the tunnel, where the tunnel was damaged, and it began to continue to suffer damage over a long period of time, and then one day the tunnel broke and there was a flood. And the court there basically says that there's no damage unless loss to the claimant happened while the policy was in force. And the court made clear that
That works for your arguments as to Midler and Faring, but what about your argument as to Brewer?
I think it makes it as to...
Because the city in that case was found to have insurance coverage for the damage to the tunnel that preceded the flood.
Well, the issue had to do with the issue of when was the damage and what did it happen. I think that case is very instructive on the issue here. Because if you read the Pfluger complaint, what the Pfluger complaint says is that Brewer should have been inspecting, Brewer should have been maintaining, and had they done those, Pfluger should have notified us that they didn't do those things and this was a system in disrepair. And had they told us, says Pfluger, I wouldn't have bought the dam. I would have done something different. And what the Great Lakes case says is that in this situation, even after the damage to the tunnel, the loss was preventable. And where it was preventable, there wasn't damage within the policy period.
So you're construing the Pfluger complaint as saying that if there was an award of damages for the dam that preceded the breach itself for the ongoing continuous injury, that damage recovery would be improper because that's not part of what Pfluger is claiming damage for.
I'm saying that in terms of the complaint that was drafted, as opposed to the complaint that perhaps Brewer wish had been drafted, the complaint doesn't ask for that. It alleges negligence, it alleges failure to maintain, but it doesn't allege damage during that time period. And what it alleges is specific negligence, which is what the trial court found. I think that the other issue, which I would like the court to look at, is first, as we said earlier, and we've been focusing on the Pfluger complaint. I mean, I think this court should, under any circumstances, affirm the trial court and specifically rule that there is no duty to defend and no coverage for Faring and Midler. As to Pfluger, I think there are other grounds upon which this court can affirm, even if this court believes that it will adopt the Godby rule or the implied idea that there was damage during the policy period. And that is the other defenses that were raised below, upon which the court didn't rule, but could have ruled, because the trial court found that there was no allegation of damage in the appropriate policy periods. And there are three reasons. The first is because the FLUGA complaint did not allege an occurrence. An occurrence in these policies is defined as an accident. And what FLUGA alleged was not an accident. They were business-related, contractual, transactional activities, which the courts of Hawaii have held do not constitute an accident. So this court could affirm on the basis that it wasn't an accident. I think the state argued that this court could not do so because it hadn't been briefed, but that's not true. It was fully briefed in the lower court. It just didn't form the basis for the court's ruling. This court can affirm on that basis. There's a Sierra Club case that makes that clear. The other things are there are two exclusions which are directly on point. One, perhaps, is the exclusion J, which is found at RA 20-195. It's sometimes called the own alienated property rule, and there are multiple categories there. These would fall right there, because if, as Brewer is alleging, there was damage to the dam while it owned it, it would be excluded by the owned property. If it was damage while their contractor was supposed to be working on it and didn't, and they failed to monitor or maintain, it would fall within one of the subdivisions there. If it comes from prior damage before they sold it, it falls within the alienated property portion. So if this court will look at exclusion J, it is on all fours. And last but not least, in my client's policies and in some of the others, there are two exclusions that involve subsidence and earth movement. And again, if, as Brewer claims, this is a situation in which there was an early erosion, that there was ongoing erosion, that somehow there was earth movement and subsidence because somehow the earth was moving, then it will fall directly within the earth movement exclusion. So this court can, and we believe should, look at those. They are a matter of law. They were fully briefed, and this court can do so. So in summing up, and I'd like to be available for any questions, I mean, across this country, we have cited the cases. Courts have been faced with arguments like here to go back in time and find coverage for events or allegations of negligence that occurred earlier. They have declined to do so, and we would suggest that this court should too. But if this court decides that the Pfluger complaint gives rise to issues that this court would like to send back to the trial court to examine further, then we would ask this court to specifically and expressly narrow this case and find, as we have requested, that there could be no duty to defend the Farron or the Midler complaints, because there is no possibility that those plaintiffs could have or did suffer injury or damage in advance. So while we ask this court to affirm in full, if this court is not inclined to do so, we ask this court to narrow the issues. And let's go back and address just the Pfluger complaint. If this court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I represent Ace, Cigna, and Pacific. I'll just address that as Ace, and I'm going to be addressing a narrow particular issue that's germane to this particular policy of Ace and other policies like that. As you know, they've alleged policies for a 20-year span or more, and I'm just going to address one issue. And the issue I'm addressing for Ace and other policies like that is that when there's an unsatisfied self-insurance retention and the policy is named or construed as an excess policy, that the trial court correctly held that we should not have been a part of the declaratory judgment action. While we do agree that the trial court should be affirmed on the grounds that were argued by Ms. Field about the date of the injury and damages, we also supplement the argument to the extent that as excess insurance policies, we believe that Pfluger, rather C. Brewer, should not have brought in those additional policies like ACE unless it alleged satisfactory requirements of the excess policies being involved or that the self-insurance retention like ACE were satisfied. By their plain terms, the ACE policies are excess of a retained limit, also known as an SIR, self-insurance retention of $250,000 for those particular policies, and there are other policies I'm arguing for that indicate that they are excess to some primary policies. And this is evidenced by all the policies that were attached to the Second Amendment complaint, and that's what we're dealing with. Your Honor, we believe that the ACE policy plainly provides that the insured is responsible for expenses and costs within the retained limit, and if it is satisfied, only then can that trigger some sort of obligation on the part of ACE, because the insured can seek reimbursement against insurers such as ACE, but we have specifically eliminated any contemporaneous duty to defend.
Isn't that a chicken and egg problem, though? How does the insured know until the coverage question or the duty to defend question is resolved whether the excess carriers are going to be implicated? So how do they do that? How do they make the allegation? Because it depends upon other rulings by the court in terms of whether the excess policies are going to be implicated.
Well, I think that, in essence, I don't believe the Seaboard had the right to make a shotgun approach to every single policy over a 20-year span or a span. I think Seaboard had the right, if not the obligation, to indicate which policy periods are specifically indicated, which primary policies are indicated, which self-insured retentions have been satisfied. I mean, for them, in this case, for Seaboard to have said over 20 years or 22 years, whatever that is, everybody, whatever layer, whatever retention level you are, is involved, I think is very overly broad. And in this particular case, let's look at the allegation. I mean, all they did was allege every single policy that could have insured Seaboard and said there's a duty to cover, or said that you have to cover, and that's it, without indicating what has been satisfied. We believe that's sort of overly broad. And I can agree with your question, and it's a good question, how will we know until the end of the game here? And all I can say is the end of the game may not be there for very long. It may require several short-term battles. It may require that in the course of the declaratory judgment, instead of taking one expansive approach for every insurer over 20 years, to indicate which insurers will be involved and other excess insurers will be involved by reason of cross-claim or third-party complaint, eventually, everybody may eventually be involved. But at that point in time, there's a satisfaction of the layers. We know exactly what we're facing rather than a broad shotgun approach that I'm going to bring everybody in. First property, excess, primary, everybody that ever wrote insurance for us. That's their approach. That's why we believe it's improper for them to do that. And in this particular case for ACE, the appellant never alleged that the cost of expenses were in excess of the retained limit or that there was exhaustion of the primary. And they argue, I think, in a declaration of Alan Van Etten, that the self-insured retention levels were satisfied because in the motion for partial summary judgment, I think they put a declaration in there against U.S. Fire. Alan Van Etten says that Seaboard had expended $250,000. Well, that may be all and fine for one policy period, but that doesn't necessarily explain how they can trigger other policies as well. I cannot imagine that the $250,000 can indicate that it's going to span for this particular time. Since they have failed to allege in the Second Amendment complaint that the SIR retention levels were satisfied in primary policies, I don't believe that they have a right to hook in the excess policies to bring them in at the same time contemporaneously until there's some satisfactory allegations. Well, there's some requisites satisfied. I know it wasn't argued by C. Brewer at the time, but in their brief they said that the H-related companies were excess and they were necessary and indispensable in the Rule 19. And I would just want to just briefly address that, and that's the only other issue I would address because, first of all, I admittedly did not catch it, but as I was reviewing the record, I realized that Seaboard had failed to raise this argument, although they raised it in the opening brief. They failed to preserve that for purposes of the appeal in the dismissal of the Second Amendment complaint. Albeit, they did raise that point for the First Amendment complaint. That's a new ground. That was an appeal.
All right, Mr. Givon, I'm going to have to cut you off because your time expired, and I want to make sure everybody had their allotted time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think I was at the end anyway, Judge. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Brad Bliss. I represent Columbia Casualty Company. Columbia Casualty issued two policies to Brewer, both of which predated the Coloco dam breach in 2006. Columbia Casualty certainly joins in the arguments made by Ms. Field earlier today, which apply equally to the Columbia Casualty policy. However, the primary focus of my argument this afternoon is a separate and independent ground upon which the court below granted summary judgment in favor of Columbia Casualty, based upon the known or continuing loss endorsement in the Columbia Casualty policy. The known or continuing loss endorsement modifies the insuring language in the policy by removing from the scope of coverage any bodily injury or property damage that occurs during more than one policy period, unless the insured did not know of the bodily injury or property damage prior to the Columbia Casualty policy periods, and the insured first learned of the property damage during the Columbia Casualty property periods. In their briefs, the appellants have argued, and we've heard argument again this afternoon, that the underlying complaint by Pfluger triggers coverage under all of these numerous policy periods, even though they expired before the dam breach, because there was continuing injury to the dam. The Pfluger complaint also alleges that from the early 1980s, the appellants had knowledge of structural issues and damage to the dam that they failed to disclose or take any action on before the dam was sold to Pfluger. Given these allegations, there was no possibility of coverage under the Columbia Casualty policies because the known or continuing loss endorsement removes from any potential coverage any damage that the insured was aware of before the policy.
But there could be coverage under that endorsement if the Brewer didn't know of any damage to the dam prior to your policy going into effect and first learned of the damage while your policy was in effect, correct? And although
it's not either or, it has to be both of
right.
those things.
But if those two facts were established in the Pfluger lawsuit, wouldn't that endorsement not preclude coverage?
That's a conceivable argument. However, we have to look at the four corners of the complaint and what was alleged in the Pfluger complaint. Those allegations were very explicit that Brewer did have knowledge of damage to the dam, of structural integrity issues, of things that should have been disclosed to Pfluger before the dam was sold, and that they did not disclose those things. That was the allegation in the Pfluger complaint. Given that fact, it did not trigger coverage under the Columbia Casualty policies.
But those allegations are also broad enough to encompass what was necessary to avoid the endorsement, correct? In other words, Pfluger is making a very broad claim. It doesn't necessarily mean that that entire claim is going to be proved to be true. And if a part of that claim was true, then wouldn't that necessarily mean that the endorsement wouldn't be an exclusion that would allow the insurance company to avoid a duty to defend?
Now, I would respectfully disagree that if Pfluger proved its claim that Brewer had the prior knowledge, there is no potential for coverage. Furthermore, under this scenario, it was incumbent on Brewer or any of the other parties appellants claiming coverage to come forward with any facts to establish a question of fact that would have precluded summary judgment. They failed to do that. We came forward and said, under the known or continuing loss endorsement and looking at the allegations in the Pfluger complaint, there is no potential for coverage.
Isn't that contrary to Derry Road?
No. In fact, Your Honor, the Derry Road case is clearly distinguishable from the facts in our case. Under Derry Road, the insurance carrier looked at the allegations of the complaint, and those allegations were in Derry Road broad enough to trigger potential coverage. At that point, the insurance carrier looked at extrinsic facts, and that's what the Supreme Court found was inappropriate in Derry Road. Here we have the exact opposite situation. In our case, the Pfluger complaint is very explicit that Brewer had prior knowledge. With that prior knowledge, there is no potential for coverage under the insuring language in the Columbia Casualty policies as modified by the known or continuing loss endorsement. And therefore, this is essentially the exact opposite of Derry Road. Our complaint is clear, the allegations were not there to support it, and Brewer did not come forward in response to our motion for summary judgment to present any facts that would create a material question of fact in order to find any duty to defend or indemnify under this policy. For those reasons, we believe that the grant of summary judgment to Columbia Casualty was proper and should be affirmed by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Bliss.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Romero with Tinshaw & Culbertson. I'm here with my friend and colleague, Keith Hiroka. We represent James River Insurance Company. Sitting back, there was such a large party of counsel. I wanted to jump up, Justice Nakamura, when you asked the question, why do insurance companies put these limitations in the policy? James River put this limitation in the policy because it wanted to limit the liability to specified premises. This is not an uncommon insurance product. It exists everywhere. And when that is done, coverage is restricted. Coverage is restricted to activities at specified premises. When an occurrence takes place off those premises, there is no coverage and no duty to defend. We believe that the trial court got it right. We also believe that C. Brewer understands that the trial court got it right. This case is different than the others. Our case comes before this court on a grant of a Rule 56 motion on summary judgment. When we filed the motion, something had already occurred that was significant. Before we filed the motion, the other carriers had already been before the trial court and had received their ruling. And when I went before the trial court, it was a different case, and it was a different case for a simple reason. We believe that counsel, who argued that very case with the other carriers, acknowledged that there could be no coverage under the James River policy. Within the briefing, and I think it's important that the court hear it verbatim, was counsel's argument before the trial court. There, on May 17, 2007, C. Brewer writes, quote, in 2005, it's November 30th actually, Brewer divested all stock in Kilauea Irrigation, and the only reason Brewer is allegedly responsible for this damage, this property damage, in each policy period is because it is allegedly the alter ego of Kilauea Irrigation. Well, everybody admits that Brewer sold its stock in Kilauea Irrigation on November 30th, 2005. So, from December 2005 through March 14th, 2006, Brewer had nothing to do with the dam or with the property. Nothing to do. They got an entirely different kind of policy. That's why James River is not bringing a motion to dismiss, and they were never a focus of our motion for summary judgment. It's totally different kind of policy, and it goes on from there, and that's before the court. It is a different kind of policy because the only named insured under our policy was C. Brewer Company Limited. It wasn't Kilauea. It's undisputed that when this dam broke, C. Brewer had absolutely no connection with this property. So that's why when the tender was received by James River, we investigated the claim. We found out what the schedule of property included. It didn't include the dam. The only named insured was C. Brewer Limited, who, as far as we know, it's undisputed, never owned the dam. And any minor interest that the C. Brewer Limited company had in a subsidiary, they had divested all ownership interests in the Kilauea company. This was all documented before the trial court. So when the trial court had the motion before it, it could see that, aha, we have an insurance contract, which under Hawaii law has to be given meaning and effect to all of its provisions. And when
has a Hawaii court construed the premises limitation?
Pardon me?
Has the Hawaii court construed the premises limitation in the context of your argument?
No, it hasn't. There's been no Hawaii court that has addressed this specific issue. However,
and Brewer cites a case that says it's enough even under this kind of premises limitation if there's some nexus between decision making on a covered on listed premises and the alleged harm. So if there's ambiguity, don't we under Sentinel, don't we have to assume that there's a possibility of coverage?
The case that you're referring to, I believe, is the American Guarantee case. The American Guarantee case is distinguishable, but the important thing to remember, which is lost in the briefing, is the American Guarantee case, as with every case before this court on the designated premises, their very case said this provision is unambiguous. Now, the court in that case dealt with an entirely different set of facts. Here, we have an insured that is completely divorced from the dam. There's no connection to it. But what were we dealing with in American Guarantee? In that case, the named insured was PepsiCo Bottling Company. The CEO had a son. Son liked to take pictures. And he said, listen, son, I'm going to open up a business for you. That business was a division of the named insured. All of the employees were employees of the named insured. The negligence claims that were ultimately made when the son had a hidden camera in the woman's dressing room, the court was easily able to find a connection to the designated premises in the named insured's business because they were one and the same. You don't have that here. Let me cite a case to you, and it's in the briefs, and I talk about it in the briefs, but it's the reason why we ask for oral argument, frankly. The case is called Union American Insurance Company versus Haitian Refugee Center. That's a case where the designated premises endorsement was in effect. It's a case where the named insured, the Haitian refugee, organized a parade, sent out invitations, got parade people. 1 mile from that parade, somebody died, somebody was shot, and a lawsuit came in. In that case, the insurance company said, well, we don't insure you for liability that occurs off your premises. And they said, well, wait a minute. There's a nexus here. You negligently failed to hire security. That's got to be enough. And the trial court bought that, so there was coverage. But on appeal, the court said, no, you can't find an ambiguity just because, as counsel stands up, it's ambiguous. It's not that easy. To answer your question directly, insurance companies put these provisions in to limit coverage. And it entirely makes sense because for 20 years, C. Brewer is in business, 20 plus years, even more. In 2005, based on their own arguments to the court, their business is being limited, to the point where they no longer own the dam, have no interest in the irrigation. So they go to market and buy a different policy. So what the court would have to do, respectfully, is rewrite this policy. In the Haitian refugee case that I just talked about, it ends with the statement, the trial judge's conclusion was based on the finding that the event at which the decedent was killed was an operation necessary or incidental to the business of the center. While this may well have been true, providing coverage on this ground involves a judicial rewriting of the policy by substituting business for the policy word premises. This is a process in which we may not engage. So respectfully, Justice Nakamura, the fact that the Hawaii courts have not specifically addressed this issue, you've been authors of several cases which tell us that this is a contract and you have to give meaning and effect to each provision of the contract, and you can't find an ambiguity where there is none. This really doesn't present a close call. We believe that the coverage was restricted to the scheduled premises, and to make the leap that some use of their last office that they had on 311 Pacific was responsible for all these ills when they were complete strangers to the dam would be a rewrite of my client's policy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Paul White, counsel for Marine Indemnity Insurance Company. We're into these arguments a fair amount of time right now. But the focus of the discussion, like the underlying case, has been on liability. Third-party liability. C. Brewer chose to include Marine Indemnity as a defendant. We submitted to the trial court that that was improper, and Judge Watanabe agreed. Some of the reasons that Marine Indemnity was properly dismissed have been highlighted in part by the very questions you asked Brewer. Is there a duty to defend in this property policy? The concession was no. This is not a liability policy. This is a first-party property policy. That distinction is significant because liability can run off of a potential for coverage. It does not run off of a potential in a property policy. Property policies provide coverage for actual indemnity that is specifically owed. You honed in on another question. What is Brewer's insurable interest here? I heard some answers, but I didn't hear an answer. I don't know what it is, because when you look at this case, you look at it and you say, there's a lot of lawsuits here, therefore liability. This is not a situation of coming in and saying, we own the dam, we want to be paid.
Well, what's the purpose of the clause in the insurance policy that extends coverage to beyond property simply owned by the insured, but also this reference to under the care, custody, or control of the insured, or liabilities imposed by contract? What is that intended to cover?
Your Honor, there can be coverage when an insurance company says, for example, if it's a situation of Belmont, if you got a dry cleaner and you drop off your shirts and it burns down, and it's they submit their claim and they say, look, we have all this property here. There can be situations where an insured does have care, custody, or control of someone else's property. But it doesn't run off of an allegation. They're not coming in here and saying, hey, we actually own the dam. One of the comments was, well, there's an allegation that we may have had some sort of interest. Let's say it's in Kealua Irrigation. Property coverage doesn't run off of that potential. It doesn't run off of what was the allegation. It runs off of what actually took place. What is the event? That's one of the big distinctions that you have with property insurance, first-party property, and liability insurance. Liability will provide that duty to defend and indemnify as to liability being confronted in claims brought by third parties. We've spent the better part of an hour talking about those liabilities. But this isn't the case where C. Brewer's coming in and saying, gosh, you know what? In 1987 to 1988, when Marine Indemnity was on the book, we had an event, because that's what the court's focusing on, is the event, the loss itself. Liability can look at things that take place over time that confront the insured with liability. First party property is looking at that actual loss. The Sutton case made a point of referring to the California Supreme Court decision in Montrose. And Montrose has a very good discussion as to why, in fact, you can have one trigger of coverage for property insurance and one trigger of coverage for liability insurance.
But Sentinel didn't make, that's not a holding of the case, is it?
Maybe. I'll say the
trial court decision was based upon the theory that the manifestation trigger applied. Now, is your argument depending upon us agreeing with the trial court on that issue, or can we affirm even if we disagree with that?
I think you can affirm even if you disagree with that, Your Honor, for the reasons I've mentioned. But when you look at Sentinel, whether you refer to it as dicta or the holding, the Hawaii Supreme Court made a point of saying, you know what, there's a really good question out there. What's the difference between liability insurance and property insurance? And they explain why. Now, they were doing so in the context of a liability insurance policy. But in distinguishing liability, they focus in also on what is property insurance. And in referencing the Montrose decision, there are a few things that happen with property insurance that are especially relevant here. One I've already mentioned, which is the loss itself. But two, with property insurance, that's the insured's own property. They're capable of looking at that and saying, what is my exposure and what do I need to insure for? They also have coverage for a loss. And a loss in Montrose was specifically referred to as something referring to something that would manifest itself or exhibit appreciable damage. And that's language that the Sentinel Court picked up on. They also noted in the Montrose decision that property policies also have a suit limitation provision saying, you know what, insured, you need to give your insurer prompt notice, and if you're going to bring a suit against them, we've got a 1-year suit limitation provision. So those provisions all come into play in identifying and highlighting. The first party property insurers are saying, we're looking at when the damage becomes appreciable. One of the other questions you asked that I thought was a great question. What is the measure of damage here? There's some note in the reply brief that, well, maybe there was some property damage in the 1987 to 1988 period. I come back to where I started. What is it? How do you measure that? There wasn't an answer to that question, and the reason is that in March 2006, the Coloco Dam collapsed. And that's why we're here. We're here because that was the event. And in a first-party property insurance world, you look to the event. You look to the appreciable damage. You look to the manifestation. And that's when that took place. If for some reason, and I see my time is up, any other questions, Your Honor? Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Right.
As I went back to look back at a couple of things, I realized that I'm not sure that I addressed the comment that Seabrewer's counsel made, that it wasn't only the Pfluger matter that gave rise to this duty to defend, but it was also a cross-complaint, I think, by Lucas and the state's claim. And the state is here to make its own claim against the carriers as an insured. But I did want to address both of those. I think if this court goes back to the Lucas cross-complaint, the court will find that it's purely a contribution and indemnity claim. It didn't allege specific damage. And if the court goes to Sentinel, I think it's important to note that the Sentinel court said that under an injury in fact trigger, each injury is discrete and must be assignable to a separate policy, and the test of coverage is a sustaining of actual damage by the complaining party. So when this court does go back and look at the issue the counsel raised of Lucas, I think you'll find that Lucas wasn't alleging damage to it in the policy periods of the pre-breach policies. I think also the same is true of the state. The state had filed a brief, and the state said, well, you know, we might allege something else. But the fact is that what the state did allege in its claim was, one, a claim for indemnity. That is, it's not our fault, it's your fault. But the second, and a very important, was the county and the state argued that after the dam breach, there had been damage that they had to deal with, cleanup and other activities, and that is what they were suing for. In the reply, the state says, well, we might expand our claims, but they couldn't expand those claims because those claims were for things that could only have happened on or after the date of the dam breach. So those are the claims that exist. I understand the court has raised the issue of Pfluger, but with respect to any other claim that was made, this court should specifically and expressly find that there is no duty to defend. And I think I've addressed all of the claims. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Mayaula may want to add a few points after I'm done, so I'd like to reserve at the end of this period 5 to 10 minutes for him, if possible. But I want to go down some of the points that I've heard. I like the last one here about the state. The permits require indemnity. That's an insured agreement. So if they wanted to get in with the state, we have an insured agreement. That's a whole different piece of things. Lucas may or may not own part of the dam. The case wasn't over at the time, although, and they may be in for that possible aspect, but it's the same damage we're talking about for Pfluger. It's either all Pflugers or partially Pflugers or Lucas's in that period of time. I didn't hear anything really that wasn't covered in the briefs that would have necessitated coming here on this, but I want to touch on a few of the things that were said. U.S. Fire suggests that there's been some bootstrapping on this interrogatory. Brewer didn't propound that interrogatory. It was Kalani that did. It's JP's, Mr. Pfluger's own words that he has suffered damage, not the insurance at that point in time. It's Derry Road, specifically overruled Blanco and Brooke on the issue of whether or not you have to look beyond the complaint. You have to look beyond the complaint if you're a carrier. You can't be listening to it. If there's any question whether the interrogatory is covered in the complaint, it's clearly involved. One of your duties when you have a vague complaint come in is to move for a more specific statement, or you can go and ask interrogatories to find out what they're really claiming. We asked, or Kalani asked, Pfluger told us. It's in there, it's not our words on it. And the carriers can't deny coverage under Derry Road for anything that's outside the complaint. But they have to look outside the complaint to see if there is a possibility of coverage for defense on it.
How do you deal with some of the exclusions that the court admittedly did not, trial court admittedly did not rule upon, but what would be in the case? For example, the earth subsidence exclusion.
I'm glad that
One policy has an irrigation operations exclusion.
I'll be glad to do that. Mr. Mayaula wants to touch on some of them as well, because part of those apply to Kalani and its previous interests as opposed to C. Brewer, which never operated and never owned any property. So the owned property, alienated property exclusion wouldn't apply to C. Brewer right off the bat. And nor would the operations exclusion, because we weren't operating the companies. But the first thing is, as you've indicated, one decided below, and perhaps trial court should have the first shot at that. Secondly, they didn't raise it on their briefs to bring it up. And thirdly, we say they all turn on the facts. Every one of those things. You have to look at what's going to be determined in the underlying case, determine what is damaged, what hasn't been damaged, by whom, whether it's a cause, whether it's an effect, all that is in play in the case below. Defense is required. Now, with respect to the individual pieces on it.
Well, how do you deal with a situation in which it seems that on the coverage question, there may be conflicting, in other words, your damage claim is seepage, ongoing, continuous damage. Whereas if you prove that, maybe that puts you right into the exclusion for earth movement. So how do you deal with the fact that to get coverage on one hand, you may have to lose coverage on the other hand in terms of the policy?
All we have to do is find one theory. And if one is requires a defense, they have to defend them all. Negligent management and operation with across the board on many different things for running that real estate business is one that doesn't come under any of those type of things. But with the subsidence, we've raised in our brief that that deals with a natural setting, not a man-made or man-implemented or man-contributed to aspect of it. To the extent that there's a, if the cases around the country are split on that, we got the legal ambiguity rule, which says a defense, to find out what that rule is. And I'm suggesting if you read the Godfrey report, this is not subsidence on top of all that. First, we're saying the subsidence and earth movement is natural and it doesn't apply. Secondly, one of the alleged mechanisms has nothing to do with that particular offense, and that's a fact issue that has to be determined in the trial below. All right. So hope I've dealt with that one. Did you have another one? Because Bill wants to talk about some
The irrigation.
The irrigation system, again, is not... The operation was by Kilauea Irrigation Company, not by C. Brewer on that. If you look at the irrigation one in the James River policy, it says ongoing irrigation operations. What's being alleged against us at that time is mismanagement for duties that arose years in advance, not ongoing irrigation business. Whatever it was we did back then, we had a continuing duty according to those people. And I think that's a defensible, that's one that requires a defense on it. And I talked off, because I know he wants to talk on it, I don't want to use his time on it, and I did have some other pieces I wanted to address.
Go ahead.
I enjoyed Mr. Romero's reliance on the Haitian case. And he admits that it has a requirement that it be necessary or incidental to the premises, which our policy doesn't have. He didn't mention to you that our policy didn't have that, did he? That's an important one, because that's what the court in the Haitian case made the distinction on. It says that you're trying to put business in there instead of premises. We have a business operations coverage in our case. And our policy has the advertising tort, which isn't limited to the premises. The Haitian case is not on point. And again, there are cases with this same language that was in there, which find that business is sufficient, even if it's not related to the premises. So there's a split out there on how to interpret that provision, which we don't even have. And I could say, with respect to almost everybody's comments, they all turn on the facts in the case below. And they jumped it. It's premature to decide some of their pieces. They should have given us a defense and fought those, so they could have really gotten out at the end of the day. And we had gotten out too. These types of claims exceed hundreds of millions of dollars. I think the damage interrogatories in the case below were over $200 million. That implicates every excess and umbrella carrier along the way. Mr. Van Etten did put in affidavit saying the SIRs had been satisfied. Was not contested by anybody, dealt with that issue. And with respect to the Columbia one, if that's a novel theory, as I understood the argument that was made today, defense is never required if you have to admit the truth of the allegations below. What you want the defense on is to fight those allegations. He's saying because Kluger said that I knew something at a certain time, I want a defense says I didn't say that, or I didn't know that. That's what they're supposed to be about. That's why you bring the defense in, to fight the allegations. I didn't understand the argument. As I say, I've already given you some ideas of possibilities that could have been determined which showed coverage within their window. Let's see here. Again, all this under Barry Road, which has been pointed out by the court, is it's the mere possibility. They've got to prove that it's impossible. And on exclusions, the burden's theirs to start with. They have to prove they're impossible in the case below. We haven't had that yet. I'm going to yield to Mr. Mayo-Lewin. We have a few things he wanted to say.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Bill Mahalula for K. Line Holdings. I just wanted to cover some of the points that were made by defense counsel. The first one was whether or not the defense should be provided in the Faring and the Midler cases. And I think that inquiry starts with the Commerce versus Bank of Hawaii case, which is not the only Hawaii case that deals with this, but it says that where a suit raises a potential for indemnification liability of the insurer to the insurer has a duty to accept the defense of the entire suit, even though other claims of the complaint fall outside of the policy's coverage. And then if you couple that with the scenario that we have here, which is that in the Faring and the Midler cases, which were filed later, they incorporated by reference all of the allegations in the Pfluger complaint. Then when Pfluger answered those complaints, he cross-claimed against us. And he cross-claimed not only for contribution and indemnity, but also for his damages. And the reason for that was the res judicata problem. If one goes first, then if you don't assert all the claims that you possibly could, you'd lose the opportunity. And of course, to take care of that problem, all of those three cases were consolidated. So, and they're all together in one case at that point, we submit for purposes of defense.
But do you have any specific authority that in that circumstance you have a duty to defend against claims brought by independent parties like the plaintiffs that are not covered at all by the policy?
No, I think the only thing I'm relying upon is that they're involved in the same case. And
right, so they don't have to provide a defense as to the Faring and the Midler allegations, the complaint itself.
Well, I submit, though, that once you're involved in a case like that, that defense counsel has to be all in. They can't, if they're defending, for example, my client, KL Money Holdings, they've got to defend the whole thing. Otherwise, they're going to be at cross purposes, which is the purpose for avoiding that kind of circumstance. Because you don't want them taking steps that are going to defend against the claims that Pfluger made and could hurt your client on the claims that Faring is making. So I believe that is the purpose for that law and that rule. And it would apply to me when you've got consolidated claims and when you've got also claims where Pfluger is making in the same lawsuit these claims. Otherwise, you'd have a circumstance where I'd be getting up and cross-examining witnesses with all witnesses, maybe, and defense counsel would be doing it for others. I wanted to address the question of whether or not there was an occurrence, because I believe Ms. Field made the argument that no, there was just this contractual obligation, there was no negligence sort of obligation or duty. First of all, in the policies, they define occurrences as means an accident including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions. In the Pfluger complaint, in paragraph 151, it alleges that KIC and Hitch owed a duty of reasonable care to the plaintiffs and others to operate, inspect, repair, and maintain the system. How we get locked into this case is that my client was the owner of, actually owned the stock of Kilauea Irrigation from its inception in 1981, right up until December 15, 1993. At that point, the stock of Kilauea Irrigation was transferred to C. Brewer. And so we believe that right up until that point in time, Pfluger had made the allegation that there was an alter ego, that we're liable for alter ego for Kilauea Irrigation, and then also for its operator, Tom Hitch. And so you've got that allegation made right there of owed a duty of reasonable care. That's an accident kind of allegation. And then if you're asking for, well, where does that duty arise from? Paragraph 65 says the duty arose out of the water rights agreement, which was between Lucas and Kilauea Irrigation. Other paragraphs say that the duty arose out of the PUC permit. Other allegations say out of the DLNR permit. Other allegations say out of the Dam Safety Act of 1987, and then other allegations say as manager of water that derives MALPA from state lands. So under these circumstances, I don't see how they can say there wasn't a possibility of an occurrence being alleged in the Pfluger complaint. On the property exclusion that Ms. Field made, and that was I think she referred to it as exclusion J. And first of all, this exclusion was first brought up in the answer brief on appeal. It wasn't alleged below at all. And so the only opportunity we had was in our reply brief. And we don't believe that's an appropriate way to resolve a situation like this, particularly when you have like 45 policies. They all have their own different type of exclusions. Some of them may have exclusions that are similar to this, but if you're going to analyze it, you need to take a look at the specific language of every exclusion, compare it to the allegations, and compare it to other information, like Sentinel says, the insurer is obligated to consider. Sentinel says the insurer must look beyond the effect of the pleadings and must consider any other facts brought to its attention. And so, you know, it's just not appropriate to evaluate it like that. But if you do, there are three that they say, three sections of exclusion J that they say apply. One of them is property you own. We sold the property to Pfluger December 18, 1987. So we didn't own it after that. The policy periods go on after that. The second one is premises you sell, not property you sell, premises you sell. And if you look below that, it defines premises as residential property. There is no residential property sold or on the reservoir. And then they have another one about a particular part of real property on which you had any contractual operating or performing operating operations. So it's a particular part of the property. So this would only apply, this exclusion would only apply if it was alleged that KIC and Hitch perform operations on every part of the real property. But in fact, their allegation was that they didn't do it. And so we believe that that exclusion would not apply even if you did a very good investigation on it and analysis on it. The earth movement exclusion is similar to the property exclusion J in that it wasn't brought up before. This one was brought up only once and in the lower court. And that was brought up in the motion to dismiss C. Brewer's second amended complaint. So this was the last series of hearings before Judge Watanabe. It wasn't brought up against my client because my client wasn't a plaintiff in the second amended complaint. C. Brewer, I think, effectively below and on appeal argued the Nautilus case. The Nautilus case is a case that said that they canvass nationally all of the courts that address these types of earth movement exclusions, and they all pretty much said that they were ambiguous, and the reason for that is because it was unclear whether it was would apply to earth movement that was natural or versus man-made. And here they do not distinguish, and therefore it would be similarly ambiguous, and because it's ambiguous and it's an exclusion, it should be construed against the insurer. And in this situation, you've got paragraph 17, saying that the defect was hydraulic filled method of building the dam in 1890. You've got an allegation in paragraph 28 that the failure to do the $1.8 million worth of repairs that were suggested or mandated by the SCS in 1982 was the cause. You've got structural instability in paragraph 29, set forth in the 1984 CSC report. Then you've got in paragraph 33, KSC's failure to address these defects as part of its maintenance and repair operation. And then you've got in the Godby report, decades of seepage, which may have caused conduits or pipes through embankment. And you've got a Pfluger's interrogatory response, which says that the failure to maintain caused this continuous, incremental, indivisible process of damage to the dam. So under all those circumstances, is it clear that it was only earth movement and what type of earth movement, and therefore this exclusion, which wasn't.
So under your theory, what would terminate the duty to defend? You'd have to file some kind of summary judgment motion in the underlying proceeding and say, what does that provision mean? Does it cover man-made versus non-man-made? Is that what it would take to eliminate the duty to defend?
Yeah, I think if you're representing the insurer in this circumstance, I think what you do is you defend under a reservation of rights, and then you take a look at where it is that you need to prove that there is no possibility of indemnity coverage. And some of it, you attack Pfluger in the underlying case. Some of it you may do in the Faring and the Midler cases, and some of it you may have to do in the deck action case because they don't arise, and you have to go after every one of them. And once you get them all done, then you can set forth and go, you know, there's no possibility of coverage, and therefore the duty to defend is over, and we're pooling our defense counsel. I think that's how you do it. I think Mr. Nakamura has a few things. Thank you.
May it please the court, good afternoon. Deputy Attorney General Reese Nakamura for the State of Hawaii. Just very briefly, I just want to respond to a couple of things. One thing that Ms. Fields mentioned was that the state has, she states that the state's claim has been limited to what they had submitted, we had submitted prior to this lawsuit being brought, which totaled at the time about $8 million in cleanup costs. I just want to bring the court's, perception as to the timing of this lawsuit as well as the parallel underlying cases. This lawsuit pretty much started out with the complaint, and then we went right into the motions to dismiss. There was no real significant discovery done. Our claims were tendered initially, but we kept going into the motions and we never really took much more discovery. And at the same time, the underlying cases were going on at the same time. So it was a really fast track litigation. So we really didn't have time to add to our claims. So that's why we have what we have in our moving papers. The other thing I just wanna follow up with Mr. Mayhew is the court had asked whether certain claims may not be defended if they're not covered. And I just want to bring the court's attention to the Supreme Court case of First Insurance Company of Hawaii versus the State of Hawaii, which is at 66 Hawaii 413, which states in part that the duty to defend has broader aspects than the duty to indemnify. Accordingly, the insurer is obligated to provide a defense against the allegations of covered as well as non-covered claims. And again, this is in my opening brief. So I'd just like to bring that to the court's attention. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement.